Our fourth case for this morning is Lewis against Epic Systems. Mr. Finkel.
May it please the court, I'm Noah Finkel, representing defendant appellant Epic Systems. Epic's interlocutory appeal pursuant to the FAA asks the court to reverse the district court's refusal to compel arbitration of this putative class and collective action based on the NLRB's D.R. Horton or Murphy Oil theory. That theory has been rejected by multiple sister circuits and the overwhelming majority of district courts that have considered it.
So let me tell you what I'm concerned about. I have the feeling that we're conflating two quite different points in this matter. One of them being the scope of Section 7 of the NLRA and its protection for concerted activities, which is the whole thing Section 7 is about. I think that's not just a procedural right to act collectively. It is the substantive right that the labor laws give. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's the ability of either a party or a collective group to choose a particular type of arbitration, namely class arbitration. So we know in the labor area that unions choose arbitration all the time. There's nothing wrong with a collective group, and I can't see any reason why, if unions can choose arbitration, then a collection of workers couldn't choose arbitration as well. But this arbitration clause doesn't seem to operate that way. This arbitration clause seems to say, we want you not to act collectively, and if that gets severed for some reason, then we're choosing court procedures, not arbitration. So it's a strange amalgam, but I don't see why Section 7 doesn't actually substantively protect the rights of the workers to join together. Maybe for arbitration, maybe for litigation. I wouldn't put a thumb in the scale either way for that.
Section 7 doesn't go so far as class and collective procedures.
And why do you say that in light of the Supreme Court's decisions, for example, East Tex against NLRB, concerted activities include resort to administrative and judicial forums. Other courts have said filing a collective or a class action constitutes concerted activity under Section 7, that's the Eighth Circuit. So where do we get that from the broad language of Section 7?
Because the broad language of Section 7 doesn't go so far as...
Well, you say that, but I'm looking at, and to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of other mutual aid or protection. So you say, with no language in the statute to support you, that means not, you know, you couldn't even have joinder, you couldn't have worker A plus worker B exercising their right to join under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and having the two of them bring a lawsuit.
Actually, I think Epic's agreement does allow for that. I think the gist of it...
But I'm saying, does Section 7 protect that right? If Section Epic
7
is complying
may,
with Section 7, then that's great. You know, we're happy.
But Section 7 may permit two employees to join together.
So why not 10 employees?
Probably allows 10 employees to join together, too.
So
the
why not an opt-in class... Well, it's not a class action, an opt-in collective procedure, which is really just N employees saying we'd like to proceed together.
I think there are four reasons why. The first is made clear in Stolt-Nielsen, Concepcion, and Italian Colors, all by the Supreme Court. There's a fundamental difference between bilateral proceedings, which could include multiple plaintiffs, and class proceedings.
Well, but I will point out to you that, first of all, Stolt-Nielsen, and actually all of the cases that I see in the Supreme Court, emphasize over and over it's the nature of the agreement. As a matter of fact, you'll recall that in Shady Grove, the Supreme Court said that even where a state said you couldn't proceed collectively, Rule 23 trumped that, and in fact, whether you like it or whether you don't like it, Rule 23 is there. Italian Colors is a situation where the only reason to avoid arbitration is because somebody was thinking that the cost of individual proceedings would be too expensive, and the court said that's not a, you know, that's not a reason. AT&T Mobility against Concepcion is just federal preemption. A state is not allowed to have a law that frowns on arbitration. Court has said that so many times, I'm surprised that they have to keep saying that, but it's very well established. But I don't see how any of that helps you.
Because I think in all those cases, there is certainly, it's not even an undercurrent, it's stated that the court recognizes the difference between a class and in a bilateral proceeding.
But
the
court has never looked at a substantive federal right to proceed collectively. And I don't need to remind you of the history of labor law, but that was, in its essence, what's going on here. That's what section...
If I might pile on a bit, EPIC, you know, pointed out in its reply brief, certainly, that Section 7 not only gives the employee the right to engage in collective action, but also the right not to do so. So what I have been wondering while reading your briefs is why you think the Supreme Court wouldn't say this is the right an employee may freely waive in an arbitration clause.
And Your Honor, I do believe the Supreme Court would say that. And I do want to set forth a bit more about the reasons why I think there's a difference here.
Thinks arbitration is a creature of agreement. And so if they've agreed to class arbitration, the court would enforce class arbitration. If they've voluntarily agreed to individual, although you don't have the right to force them to do that under the FLSA, but the court enforces the agreement.
They do, and here the agreement is that there's no class waiver.
But you didn't have the right to do that. That's the problem. Prohibiting any more than you could say to all of your workforce, we forbid you to join a union. You would agree that that's not...
I would agree.
It's not permissible under the NLRA.
I would agree with that, and I think this is different for, you know, first is the reasons, the differences between class and bilateral arbitration, certification notice, and most importantly, the right to represent others that are passive parties to the litigation and have representative testimony, where in court, one person's testimony gets kind of attributed to others.
But of course, you do get a lot of benefits from arbitration, even if it's class. You have no jury. You can specify, you know, an arbitral tribunal. I looked at the American Arbitration Association's class arbitration rules right before this argument. You get to have, if you want, an expert arbitrator or a panel of three, if that's what you want. You have a lot in any kind of arbitration, including class arbitration.
Yeah, and the agreement here prohibits class arbitrations.
I know it does. Just saying that your brief makes it sound like the world comes to an end if it's class arbitration, and I'm saying that there's still many of the benefits of arbitration in a class setting.
There may be, but those are not what the parties chose here. The other reasons why I think it does the general Section 7 right doesn't extend here is that, first of all, these class and collective action rights in and of themselves, from the statutes that have created them, have been deemed to be non-substantive rights.
They're not the ones we're talking about as substantive rights. We're talking about Section 7 as a substantive right of the employees to say, we've decided to create a group of 10 people and we're going to litigate together. And you think they can't do that. And I don't see that in Section 7.
Okay. And our argument, to be clear, is not that 10 employees can't get together to file a joint arbitration demand or put their names together on a caption. The issue here is the class. It's the collective. And that's what we think. There's never been a ruling that extends Section 7 that far. And in fact, if it did, per the Supreme Court's Italian Colors decision, doing so would violate the Federal Rules Enabling Act.
Could 1,000 people get together without having a class?
They could.
It doesn't violate the Rules Enabling Act if the substantive right doesn't come from the rules. It's the rules that are not allowed to create substantive rights. If Congress wants to create substantive rights in a statute, that's what Congress is there for.
Yeah, and these were rights that at the time the NLRA was passed did not exist, 1935.
Well, and you said that, but I happen to be interested in the history of class actions, and they have existed since the medieval period. The class action as adopted in 38 was taken directly from equitable systems. There had been class actions in the 19th century in the United States. Congress was well aware of collective actions at the time the NLRA was passed.
And you know, and this, we think that the, you know, and I agree that these, you know, Section 7 can expand to contemplate, you know, other activities that didn't exist in 1935 or existed in some other form, like class action here.
And you also have agreed, I think, that employers are not allowed to force employees to proceed individually if they wish to exercise their Section 7 rights?
Depending on how they do it.
Where does it say that?
Well, no, I think an employer can require employees to waive their right to follow the Rule 23 and other state law equivalent class action provisions
provisions. Why is that consistent with National Licorice, for example? Contracts stipulating the renunciation by the employees of rights granted by the NLRA are unlawful and may be rendered unenforceable.
National Licorice and another case that's similar to a JI case were both decided before the Taft-Hartley amendments in 1947 to the NLRA, and that amendment inserted not only do employees have the right to engage in protected concerted activity, they also have the right to refrain from it, so that allows employees
to... But that's the employee's choice. That's not the employer forcing the employee. That's the critical thing. No employee who doesn't want to be part of a collective action, as I understand it, could be forced to be a part. That might even affect Rule 23. I don't know, but
yeah. Well, in this circumstance, Jacob Lewis did make that choice to agree to EPIC's arbitration agreement.
No, he didn't. He was told this or nothing.
Well, he was given a choice of either voting I understand and agree or contact me because he'd like someone to talk to him about it.
He was sent the arbitration
agreement at 4:13 p.m. on April 2nd, and at 9:44 the next morning, he clicked on the button, I understand and agree, never asked a question. He also never submitted any evidence in the record that he himself subjectively felt like he had no other choice but to agree to that.
Okay. Mr. Finkel, if this issue were to get to the Supreme Court and the court saw things your way, wouldn't the court almost have to overrule cases like Gilmer?
I don't believe so. I think, you know, Gilmer is another decision. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I may have missed your question. Could you repeat it, please?
I'm just wondering if it got to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And your view was to prevail. Wouldn't the court have to overrule those cases?
I don't believe Gilmer would need to be overruled. Gilmer is another pro-arbitration decision where arbitration ultimately was compelled. So I think the Supreme Court would likely follow all its decisions that pursuant to the FAA that agree with arbitration. You know, Gilmer under the Age Discrimination Act did not find that there was a substantive right to a collective action.
Right, because the Age Discrimination Act doesn't give people, it's about individual rights.
But in a labor context, isn't that the substantive issue that's being put forward by Congress with the creating a right to have concerted activity? Isn't in the labor context the right to work together the actual substance rather than the procedure?
There is. I agree with that, Your Honor. And I think that it's a question of what form does that take and when does it get protected, and particularly against the FAA. And I think the FAA provides a second reason why this decision should be reversed. It says that arbitration agreements should be enforced according to their terms.
Except
there's a savings
clause, right.
Exactly,
and that's been the issue.
Right, and it's looking for a contrary congressional command. which I believe does not exist here. It is not in the text of the NLRA, unless you divine it from general principles. It's not in the legislative history. And so
why isn't it correct that they could be required to arbitrate, but if they choose to proceed as a group, either under the FLSA or under Rule 23, you're required to have it be that kind of arbitration? See, that's why I want to say I think we're blending too much here. So arbitration, fine, but they have a substantive right to do it collectively. That's what you've shut off in this agreement.
You're right, I'll ask the question, I'm out of time, but I believe EPIC's agreement does allow the group of employees to organically file a lawsuit. The issue is whether they can avail themselves of those certain procedures once they get into court. That's what we think has been waived here, and that's where we think the waiver is permissible.
All right, thank you. I think we hear first from Ms. Madden.
May it please the court, the central question here is whether employees can be compelled to waive their substantive rights to take concerted action on behalf of themselves and their fellow employees.
So do you agree with me that Mr. Lewis could be held to his agreement to arbitrate, but he just has to have the right, if he wishes, to use class arbitration as well as individual arbitration?
I agree with your point that if he wished to have an individual claim, he could be compelled to arbitrate and follow those terms. But the issue with EPIC's agreement is that precludes any concerted action. And to correct a point made by the appellant, this agreement does prevent joinder. On page 11 of the record, it states, I agree that covered claims will be arbitrated only on an individual basis, and it also precludes an arbitrator from joining together individual claims. So that's not an option here. There must be some mechanism permitted to Mr. Lewis and any other employee to act on their own behalf and on behalf of fellow employees.
Is an agreement to collective arbitration enforceable?
If that was what was in this contract, certainly that would be enforceable. The NLRA just requires under Section 7 that some outlet exist for workers to join together to bring these claims for their mutual aid and protection, whether that be through arbitration. But here, EPIC hasn't agreed to that. They've clearly stated they do not want to do class arbitration, which is their prerogative. I also wish to address this idea of whether Mr. Lewis had a choice in this agreement. As pointed out on page 15 of the record, the choice he got was, I agree, or someone talk to me. There's no evidence in the record of an opt-out procedure or a mechanism whereby Mr. Lewis could have avoided being bound by the terms of this agreement outside of tendering his resignation the moment after receiving this email. And regardless, because the Supreme Court has long held that employment agreements requiring the waiver of a substantive right under Section 7 are not legal contracts, he couldn't have agreed to this contract anyway, even if there had been some freedom to do so. I'd like to turn to...
So yes. You're reading, I'm looking probably lots of places, but at page 4 of EPIC's brief, it's quoting from the arbitration agreement, and it says in the carryover, I understand that if I continue to work at EPIC, I will be deemed to have accepted this agreement. So you understand that the converse of that is true, that if you don't accept the agreement, you're not going to be continuing to work at EPIC.
Yes, Judge, and there's no way for them to opt out. There's no mechanism for an employee to refuse to sign or to in any way opt out of this agreement, and that's the clear text here. There's been no presentment of evidence from the appellant of how an individual could opt out of this proceeding.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you the questions that I asked Mr. Tinkle that really is better directed to you. If this issue were to get to the Supreme Court and the court saw things your way, wouldn't they have to overrule cases like Gilmer?
Not at all, Judge. The Supreme Court has never addressed this issue where the right to a class action procedure is guaranteed by the by a statute. So here we have the Section 7 right to take concerted action, which the board, since its inception, has confirmed and circuit courts have also recognized includes the right to file a legal action on behalf of oneself and one's fellow employees.
Now, of course, you agree, as you must, I assume, that if we were to agree with you, we would be creating a substantial conflict in the circuits. Not that we can't do it, but it is, I think, a fact.
Yes, but I would also point out that the Fifth Circuit is truly the only circuit that's expressly head-on examined this issue. The Second and the Eighth Circuits have sort of dispensed with the NLRA question in a footnote, and the Fifth Circuit is the only one that's truly examined the role of the NLRA, and appellees argue that it's done so wrongly.
And haven't the Second and the Ninth Circuits suggested in dicta that they would follow along with the Fifth Circuit?
Suggested, yes, but they have not truly engaged with the analysis here. And that analysis requires this court to attempt to give a reading of the NLRA and the FAA that is in harmony. And that's where the Fifth Circuit erred, by finding a conflict between those two statutes instead of attempting to give effect to both.
But her question, Judge mm-hmm. Wood's question was, wouldn't we create a conflict in the circuits? Isn't the answer to that question yes?
Yes, it is. But the Fifth Circuit failed to defer to the board's interpretation of what constitutes a substantive right, instead conflating the collective action right under the Section 7 of the NLRA with the FLSA. And it also...
So are there other instances you can think of? Obviously, most of the arbitration cases that have reached the Supreme Court, with the exception of Italian Colors at the top of my head, have involved the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act, on the one side, and various state law provisions that disadvantage arbitration in one way or the other on the other side. And the Supreme Court has consistently said, using principles of federal preemption, the states are not allowed to do that. The Federal Arbitration Act is a strong federal policy in favor of arbitration, etc. Italian Colors involves two federal statutes. It involves arbitration and the antitrust laws, but the court says there, we can't find anything in the antitrust laws that undermines the utility of arbitration. Indeed, cases like Mitsubishi and other cases have said affirmatively that you can arbitrate antitrust claims. And so they just had a bad reason. So I want to know, are there any other cases you can think of other than yours where the task has been harmonizing two federal statutes in a horizontal sense, if you will, not the vertical preemption analysis?
This is not a Supreme Court case, but both the Fifth Circuit and the D.C. Circuit have considered agreements to arbitrate where the arbitrator was precluded from awarding punitive damages in a Title VII context. So there you have another federal statute, and that federal statute provided a substantive right to be awarded punitive damages were they to be successful on their claim. And the Fifth Circuit case is Hadnot versus Bay, the D.C. Circuit is Booker. And in both of those cases, the circuit court removed that clause and said you can't use our under the shield of an agreement to arbitrate, strip out this substantive right. And that's what the lower court here did. It said this clause precluding any type of concerted action by employees is not enforceable because it illegally strips a right that's granted by the NLRA. And so following the terms of EPIC's own agreement, this case proceeds in the court. And so I think the Supreme Court, I don't believe, has had a similar situation, but has been clear in its own dicta in Concepcion and in Italian Colors that the clear stopping point for the enforcement of an arbitration agreement is where a substantive right is implicated.
And so at the bottom of page 3 of your brief, you have included the language of the clause in the agreement that says if the class waiver is unenforceable, quote, then any claim brought on a class, collective, or representative action basis must be filed in court of competent jurisdiction, close quote. So that's this case, but I take it any other employer who thought that arbitration was still worth it on a class basis could have written the opposite, could have said if the class waiver here is unenforceable, then any claim brought on a class basis will proceed in class arbitration. They could have said that.
Exactly. That Stolt-Nielsen makes clear that both parties would have to agree to a class arbitration, and EPIC hasn't here. And again, this doesn't thwart the FAA. It, in fact, recognizes that freedom of contract. That is how EPIC chose to write its agreement. And just the sliver of it that is illegal under the NLRA is the portion that can't be enforced and requires some procedure, some mechanism for Lewis to bring this claim on his behalf and behalf of his fellow workers. And
this is just an FLSA claim in this particular case, or does he have other theories?
There are underlying state law claims that are similar to the FLSA claim, yes. So, but both of which would be covered by the agreement had he brought them individually, but because he brought them concertedly, he filed the claim in state court, in federal court, per the agreement. So this court's duty is to give effect to both the National Labor Relations Act and the Federal Arbitration Act, and that's where the Fifth Circuit failed by choosing to follow the FAA and overreading Concepcion as a shield that says any agreement to arbitrate should trump other statutes. That's not what Concepcion requires, and the job of the courts is to give effect to both statutes where possible. It's easily done here. The lower court did it by following the terms of EPIC's own agreement. So the unenforceable illegal provision of EPIC's contract has been stripped out, and I would urge this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Burritt.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Burt. I'm here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board, and I'd like to thank this court for allowing the board to participate in this case as amicus. Your Honor, as I believe that Lewis's reply brief properly flags, the central issue here is whether employees have the right to come together with one another in an attempt to enforce the workplace protections that benefit them as employees. We believe that it's clear from the statute itself, from Section 7, which provides the broad-scale right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid and protection, that they do have this right, and it is indeed a substantive one.
Now, of course, the NLRA protects employees whether or not the workplace is unionized.
That's correct, and that is part of something that gets a bit conflated in many labor cases, and I think that confusion has maybe touched on this case as well, is we're not just talking about the right to engage in collective action, which is also specifically referenced in Section 7, but the broader right, as the court has acknowledged repeatedly, and including in East Tech that Your Honor has discussed, this broader right to engage in mutual aid and protection, whether or not there's a union present, and that's the bedrock on which our federal labor policy has been built. We see that in the Norris-LaGuardia Act as well as the National Labor Relations Act, that this is not, the Act is not a procedural mechanism to accomplish other ends. Of course, the board believes that if the plaintiffs have a valid case under the Fair Labor Standards Act, that they should have their remedy, but that is not what the Act is designed to do, to somehow support.
Mr. Burritt, I understand the distinction that you and the plaintiff are drawing between a right that is substantive and a right that is procedural, but just as a matter of logic, how can we justify affixing a different label to the very same right to collective action depending on the context? In other words, if the right to pursue a class action is substantive under Section 7 and cannot be waived, then doesn't that cast doubt on the outcome of a case like Gilmer, for example? I'm back to singing the same song I was singing all along.
Yes, Your Honor. When the individuals who are statutory employees under the National Labor Relations Act come into court or come into before a tribunal, they carry with them a basket of rights, and one of those rights is the right under Section 7 to engage in collective activity. Now, the cases such as Gilmer and the other individual rights cases that have been widely discussed, they do not include that right, or if in any of those cases it could have been asserted, it was not. So in those cases, the substantive right being protected is the right to remain free of age discrimination or the other protections provided by those various statutes. Any right to engage in collective action under those statutes that's referenced in those statutes has been found to be ancillary, not, as the Supreme Court has put it, not the principal purpose, not the critical point behind Congress enacting those statutory protections. Here, with the additional right provided by the National Labor Relations Act, as I said, the bedrock right of federal labor policy to engage in collective action, they bring that additional right into court with them. So that is the distinguishing feature between those cases and this. And going to the question that you've asked the other counsel, the board doesn't believe that this would require an overruling of Gilmer at all. Those can be perfectly reconciled with those cases because, I said, they involve individual rights. They don't include this right that we're talking about here. And that is why the Supreme Court in Concepcion and in Gilmer and these other cases has not, as the Fifth Circuit and as several other circuits in dicta have suggested and certainly other district courts have suggested, is not controlled by Concepcion or those other cases because they haven't considered the additional right that is guaranteed by Section 7.
Are any more cases like this coming up before the board at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the current count of decisions that have been issued by the board is 38. I believe more will be coming in the very near future. Employers have seen this as a very effective mechanism to employ and continue to do so. To date, it's been mainly on a large-scale basis, which is why so many of these cases end up before the Fifth Circuit. But as other employers are utilizing these, it has started to spread throughout other circuit courts, and we are now have cases, many of which involve the board as a party challenging a board order, several others that are in the posture of this case, but are before all of the courts of appeals, aside from, I believe, two or three, the first, sixth, and the tenth, I don't believe, has this pending yet. So it is coming. Your Honor, just addressing briefly, it's already been discussed quite well, but the cases of J.I. Case, National Licorice, and this court's decision in NLRB v. Stone, these cases clearly stand for the proposition that these type of rights may not be prospectively waived. I think if that we came here and we had an agreement that suggested that employees were voluntarily giving up their rights to earn minimum wage or voluntarily giving up their rights that are provided by the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, which was an issue in Gilmer, we wouldn't be here. That would be a non-starter. Or if we were, it would be one of the easier cases you've probably seen. But we're talking about a right that is not quite as well understood, not suggesting by this court, but in the broader context of how these cases are coming up. But we believe that the rights provided by Section 7 are afforded the same level of importance or should be accorded the same level of importance as the rights provided in those statutes. And in order to do that, we believe that the district court's decision should be upheld.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Burritt.
Thank you for your time.
And I'm sure you have something further, Mr. Finkel, so welcome back.
Thank you. I think what pulls this all together is that there's a syllogism in the board's test here. It's that class action is a form of protected concerted activity. It's employees getting together to assert a right. Protected concerted activity is a core part of Section 7, and Section 7 is critical to the NLRA. Therefore, a class action is critical to the NLRA. And therefore is a substantive right. I don't agree with that logic because I think there are some forms of collective action that may be important to the NLRA and may be central to the NLRA, but not all of them.
So what's your response to Ms. Madden's comment looking at the language of this particular thing that it's, as a matter of fact, even two people under this clause are not allowed to litigate together?
Well, it does say that an arbitrator may not combine their claims, but it does not say that two employees may not bring their claims together.
Well, it says, I also agree that covered claims will be arbitrated only on an individual basis, and no party may bring a claim on behalf of other individuals, and then it has the stuff about the arbitrator. I'm giving you an extra minute or so.
Okay, and I can address that.
Yeah.
I mean, to the extent that's what it means, and I think what it means is that it's brought on a bilateral basis where it's not one person representing other unnamed parties or even named parties who don't appear in court. To the extent that it is interpreted that way, under Wisconsin law, it can be severed, and the court should still give effect to the central meaning of what the agreement is, which is class and collective actions. I'd also note that this is not an issue where all forms of collective action, I use that with a small c and a small a, have been shut off. Our brief sets forth the many different ways where employees can get together to bring their claim, either through a series of individual cases that are coordinated, through going to the Department of Labor, bringing it to their union, forming a union, or even jointly filing a claim together, provided that that is severed from the agreement.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.